Our final panel today has to do with looking at the marketplace through the Chicago lens, as well as looking at ways to increase agribusiness profitability. And I asked these veteran Chicago traders and business people to really look into the future, look through a crystal ball at what might be in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years out, and to offer up some ideas, again, of thinking outside the box, thinking outside the comfort zone, doing things a little bit perhaps differently than you've done it before, with an eye toward increasing your bottom line. Because after all, this is a business and you want to make the most money you can. So with that in mind, I'm going to have our three panelists talk for, a few minutes, as long as they're comfortable, about some of these issues and some of the things that they were thinking about. And then we'll have a panel discussion, and we'll also entertain your questions as well. First off, I'd like to have Tom Fritz of EFG out of course, Chicago, Illinois, speak. He has actually served at the Chicago Board of Trade, past member there. He comes from a long line of professionals stretching back a generation to his grandfather. He has over 30 years of experience. He's been a senior analyst for a major grain processing firm. He's been a former vice president of research. He's been a floor operations manager. He's known in the trade for his work on strategic hedging and trading programs. And, of course, now he's with EFG, of which he is a partner. Tom, it's a privilege, and I look forward to what you have to tell us this afternoon. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Dave. Good afternoon, everybody. How to increase your profitability? That's a great question. It starts with making money, not being right. So many people in this industry, they're in it to be right. They want to be right. Doesn't everybody want to be right? So many times it doesn't happen. It's all about making money. When it comes down to the producer, when I first got into this business, it was growing the crops, 70% of the battle, 30% marketing. Over my 35 years, that's changed dramatically. It's now 30% growing the crops, 70% marketing. You have to have a plan. I grew up on the trading floor. The adage was, plan the trade, trade the plan. You have to have a plan. When does your plan start? Your plan is working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 12 months out of the year. You're constantly making notes on what's happening in the market, how your crops are growing, and you have to go back to those notes week after week, month after month. You have to pay attention. With our markets changing, they become more and more global every day. It's not just what goes on in this country. It's about the entire world. And right now, we're looking at an explosion of food demand. Everybody's aware of what's happening in the Middle East. You see them driving up oil prices. It did not start with oil. It started with food costs. Tunisia started, spilled into Egypt. Now it's in Libya, Bahrain. Friday is going to be a day of rage in Saudi Arabia. It's about food costs. The United States, my opinion, does not have enough acreage to produce everything that's needed. I'm not sure if we have the potential for that much more expansion. So that puts more importance on your marketing. You have to be aware of that all the time. The global demand for food is not going to go away. It's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. I believe it was 1989. China had a big demonstration in Tiananmen Square. They squelched that uprising, but then they started buying food. How do you keep your people happy? You have to keep them fed. So with that in mind, every year is going to be different. What's going to be more profitable? Is it going to be growing corn? Is it going to be growing beans? Is it going to be growing wheat? That rotation is going to change every single year. And you guys have to be aware of that. And through your marketing, through paying attention to what's going on in the world, is going to help you make that decision. Right now, the big one on the table, growing corn. Are we growing it for food? Are we growing it for fuel? Now, that's a battle I don't have an answer to. I can give you my opinions. I do think Congress is going to slowly but surely do away with the ethanol subsidies. Less demand for corn. But I also think China is going to come on in the next year to 2 years, and they're going to start buying corn. They haven't done it yet. There was a big meeting this past weekend in China. It was the annual People's Congress. The biggest feed manufacturer over there asked their government to stop the investigation into the United States dumping DDGs. They're not buying corn? No, they're trying to get by on DDGs right now. If ethanol production starts to slip, those DDGs won't be there. They'll have to come for corn. So I think in the coming year, it's going to be all about your corn marketing. South America's had a tremendous oilseed crop this year. That's going to squelch beans a little bit. But right now, the demand for protein goes back to the world demand for food. Who's going to be on the short end of the stick this year? It's going to be soybeans. My opinion, I think corn, unless we have a growing scare this season, which we usually do, you'll get a spike up in corn, but then it will retreat if we do get the needed acres. Whereas soybeans, if we do have a growing scare, that spike will keep going. Wheat, who knows what goes on in the world wheat market right now. After last year's poor crop in Western and Eastern Europe, the demand for wheat, the demand for bread, it's sky high. We have problems with our wheat crop this year. You hear the stories about the hard red winter wheat down in the southern plains. The condition's not very good. Soft red wheat, you've heard very little about the condition of that. But given where new crop corn prices are, new crop bean prices are, it opens the door for tearing up that soft red wheat. It opens the door for additional double cropping acres. The demand for wheat's not going to go away. So the demand for your crops are just going to continue to go up and up and up. So that's why your marketing is going to be so important. Who's the wild card in this equation? It's the investment funds. There's $650 billion of investment money in our grain markets. That number's not going to get smaller. It's just going to get bigger. The world population is getting bigger. The demand for food's getting bigger. It's a great investment. But when the funds are in the marketplace, you see the increase in volatility. A lot of people don't like that increase in volatility. They like it when the market's going up. They don't like it when the market's going down. Those are creating opportunities for you. We have futures. We have options on futures. They are there for your use. Last summer, so many people sold their corn cheap. The adage was, we're going to have a killer corn crop. We're going to have more than what we need. What, the lows were made in June, July? How many people sold their corn and didn't replace it? These tools are here for your use. You have to take opportunity when opportunity comes banging on your door. It's not a light tap. It's banging on your door. So, in summation, marketing, marketing, marketing. It's going to command a lot of your time, but in the end, it's going to pay off for you.
Joe Vaclavic began his career in the brokerage industry working for a prominent ag marketing firm. He now works both with private and industrial speculative traders as well as grain and livestock producers at MF Global, and he prides himself on his ability to research markets and provide unique information through his grain wire every morning, which includes outlook and trade recommendations. Joe, it's a pleasure to have you here in person. We've had you on Commodity Week a number of times. Thank you for being with us, and the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much. First off, it's great to be here. The majority of my day on a day-to-day basis is spent dealing with much shorter-term issues, day-to-day market movement, stuff like that. So an opportunity like this to talk about some longer-range issues and some ideas as to, you know, how you might be able to increase profitability on your operation is something that I don't get to do very often, and it's something that I feel like I do know something about. I know all you guys are looking at me saying, man, that guy's really young. He's probably the youngest guy in this whole place. But to be honest with you, to let you know what I do and where my background is, I'm a commodity broker in the truest sense of the word. I am, at any given point, the busiest guy in an office of 100 brokers in Chicago. I do a lot of hedge business. I do a lot of speculative business. I'm on the phone all day long. My job in general is to, A, keep people out of trouble, and, B, help you to make some money and put you in a position where you guys need to be as producers. That means knowing my customer. It means knowing where your position is in the cash market and in the futures market and, you know, where you stand in the middle of that. I feel like I've got a pretty good idea here as to what you guys go through on a daily basis. I think that I can shoot some ideas your way here that might, you know, like I said, A, keep you out of trouble, B, keep you, you know, in the realm of profitability in a spot where you tend to, you know, take advantage of the big moves and, you know, try to eliminate or minimize any kind of downside. One thing that Tom mentioned and one thing that I think is the biggest thing on your road to becoming profitable or becoming more profitable is awareness. I think that before you can make any big decisions on anything in your operation, any marketing, any trading, you first need to be aware of the landscape in which you're dealing with. You need to be aware of all kinds of costs, not just the cost of the board, but you need to know, you know, what the cash prices are, not only for nearby, but also for the deferreds. You've got to know, you know, where your basis levels are at. You've got to know what kind of crop insurance is available to you this year and what it's going to cost and what your options are there. You need to know where the board's at. And I don't only mean the futures contracts. You should have a basic working knowledge as to option prices. Where are the option prices? What can you buy these puts for? What can you buy these calls for? And, you know, you should keep that in the back of your head. And this is something that you should really be looking at on a daily basis, because when the opportunity comes, in so many situations, guys miss them because they're not aware of what's available to you. You should be aware that over-the-counter markets are something that's becoming available more and more to producers. It in the past has been something only that's been available to hedge funds, to elevators, and now I'm seeing more. It's coming down from those guys into the larger individual producers and is eventually going to be something that's available to even the smaller producers, and that's something that we're just starting to get going. You need to be aware of government policies. Any changes in the farm bill, any changes that can affect you know, positively or adversely. And these are all things that you need to be aware of on a daily basis, which really sounds like a lot, but, you know, it's really part of the job description these days. And as Tom said, you know, that's far more than half of the job as a producer these days. You know, you have to know all this stuff. So basically what I'm going to talk about a little bit later here, I think, is, you know, a couple outside the box issues also. And Dave mentioned that would be, you know, a real good thing to bring up. I think that, you know, nowadays more than ever, I think the realm of what's possible in the markets and in your operation is a lot bigger than what it used to be. There's a lot more at stake here. There's a lot more on the table. There's a lot more money that's available to you, but there's a lot more risk. So, you know, if you can kind of keep on top of that, and I am going to go through a couple, you know, little examples later that I want to hear these guys' opinions on also, I think we might be able to help you out a little bit today.
Roy Huckabee has over three decades of experience at the Lind Group, and he is the man for day-to-day operations where he oversees the group's market research. He works in commodity sectors where he concentrates in commercial hedge operations for exporters and feed manufacturers. He authors a daily grain fundamental wire. And he also has provided many consultations over the years with farming marketing while continuing to focus on what he calls risk control and option pricing alternatives within the Lind Group consulting team as they come together and decide as a group what the best strategies are. We've had Roy on our Commodity Week program on a number of occasions. He has always got tremendous response back from our listeners when he's been on. And maybe he doesn't know that, but we know it, and we share that with him today. And it's a pleasure to have him here this afternoon. Sir, the floor is yours.
I'm going to go back a little further than your history shows. Mr. Stark over here, marketing in Champaign. His predecessor, Tom Widener, 40 years ago this year, hired me. I was an Air Force brat. I just separated from the United States Air Force and ran to Illinois as a Minuteman missile instructor. My wife worked for Tom Widener as a secretary, and we had a dinner party Sunday afternoon. He says, I have a job available. You want to come talk to me about it? And lo and behold, this character hired me as a grain buyer for the Andersons. I worked for the Andersons for 8 years, and to Tom Widener's chagrin, moved my wife and me both to Toledo, Ohio, and left Tom high and dry without a secretary. I learned the grain business, or started to learn the grain business, from Gus Warsaw. So all of those names will be familiar to those guys that live around that area. I don't know what to talk about as far as the markets. The volatility is here to stay, guys. It's not going to go away. This is not a situation that we can grow out of in 1 year. It's going to take multiple years to solve our supply issue. When I talk about a supply issue, let's break the markets down. Corn and feed grains are tight all over the world, and just as tight in the rest of the world as they are here in the United States. Beans are tight in the United States, but not so tight in the world. We have plenty of wheat in the United States and around the world. What we're missing, maybe, is quality wheat. But we have wheat that'll help us stretch our feed grain supplies. I think the Southeast has already bought 30 or 40 million bushels of soft wheat from their domestic growers and from Canada to take care of maybe half or two-thirds of the soft wheat that we'll feed the United States this year. I don't think that we have enough hard wheat available that we can afford hard wheat to get down to a level where we can feed it, and it's getting pretty close in today's market. I go back to Tom's comments about the upset population in the Middle East and in North Africa. This is about personal freedoms. It's about leadership that has raped those countries and taking billions and billions of billions of dollars and squirreled it away. And when this outbreak started, it did start about food prices. In North Africa, Tunisia, Algeria, have always subsidized food prices to the population. When the world economies developed a little bit of weakness, they pulled those subsidies back. So food prices went up. And then the market started to rally and food prices went up again. And when you're in an economy that you spend 40% of your disposable income for food, a 15% increase in food prices, you got a problem. You can't afford to eat every night. They're not eating three meals a day like we do anyway, especially one like the lunch we just had. So I think that the biggest thing that I see coming out of the Middle East is that everybody's gotten used to just-in-time inventories. The United States government doesn't carry inventories anymore. When's the last time one of you forfeited on a loan from the government and the government put it in the reserve and prices had to go up 50% to buy it back out? It doesn't happen anymore. In the rest of the world, nobody's carrying reserves either except China, and they're having a hard time rebuilding those reserves. So I think the first thing you're going to see out of this environment is a rebuilding of security reserves for a lot of the world. And that's going to make our demand for the next year look even bigger than it is this year. In China, in the last 6 or 7 days, the Chinese government had restricted all of the industrial users of corn from bidding while they were trying, Sinogram was trying to build their corn reserves. And they've turned them loose in this last week. Coming back out of their holidays, everybody's bidding for corn. The price of corn in China is up 35 to 40 cents a bushel equivalent. At the same time, our markets have broken 40 cents a bushel. We're getting back to where the price of importing corn into China from the United States has been well above their domestic prices in the South. And over the last few days, it's gotten to where we're only about 15 cents a bushel over Chinese domestic corn prices. Now, if you add their import duties, we're materially above that. But I think China has lost the ability to feed themselves. And this ability to hold down the domestic price of corn by telling everybody, first of all, you can only have 3 months' supply. Okay. Now you can only have 15 days' supply. Now you can't bid for corn because I'm trying to build my reserves. They can only hold corn prices down for so long. And as the Chinese corn prices come up, it's going to pull U.S. prices up with it. And I think that's coming. We haven't had a weather blow-off in these markets yet. We haven't had any panic buying. The markets have been very methodical. The range in corn so far this year has been $4. The range in corn in 03 was only 40 cents. So when I talk about volatility, that's the type of volatility I think you're going to have. It's still going to stay around. Insurance is a government-subsidized program that offers you a pretty good put. And with a 601 fixed price for these corn and an 85% program giving you 85% of that, prevent plant will give you 60% of that. There is a huge reason to be involved with the insurance program. You just got to buy as much insurance as you feel comfortable buying. By doing that, you don't have to worry so much about marketing your crop. It'll take care of itself. If you have old crop corn left, bless you. Above $7, you shouldn't have too much old crop corn left. If you've got new crop corn that you haven't marketed, I think you'll get plenty of opportunities to market it. Dave?
All right, then. Tom, I heard you say that times are a-changing, that farming today is now 30% growing the crop and 70% marketing the crop. So, what should the prudent, smart, edgy, intelligent, rich marketer have in their toolbox in order to get that job done?
What do you have in your toolbox? Number one, you have a broker you can trust. Number two, you have a good knowledge of the futures markets, the options on futures, because these tools can be put to use for your benefit. You have to be able to figure out what profit levels are you looking at, what profit levels would you like to see, and then you apply these tools to that so you can achieve that. With that in mind, you've got to be constantly aware of where prices are, and I'm not so much the Board of Trade, but where your local prices are, what your basis is. And then from there, you can start making marketing decisions. It's like, how can I get the biggest bang for my buck? I hear people talk about sell your crop, replace it with a cheap option. I don't believe in cheap options. They're cheap for a reason. The people who sell them to you know they're cheap for a reason. They're not going to work. When I got into this business, you want to make money? You had to have money to start. Buying something on the cheap doesn't work anymore. I get a lot of phone calls from guys. You know, they say, you know, I just sold some of my crop. I want to replace it. What's a cheap call? I said, the cheap call is not going to afford you anything. That cheap call is going to stay cheap. It's so far out of the money. Said, well, what do I do? I says, you're going to have to be willing to spend a little bit. What's the adage? You get what you pay for. How many times you buy a piece of merchandise for cheap and it turns out to be a piece of junk? Same thing holds true in the option markets. You sell your crop. You sell a portion of your crop. You want to replace it. Nobody likes, a lot of guys don't like buying futures because, you know, if you're wrong, that means margin calls. Well, that's all part of the plan. Okay, I sold a certain percentage of my crop. I replaced it with futures. This is how much I want to risk. You have the plan. Well, I don't want to be subject to margin calls, so I'll buy a call. Okay. They said, well, I don't want to spend very much. I said, then you're not replacing what you just sold. Well, it's pretty expensive. Well, okay, how about this? Let's buy a call that's closer to the money. We'll sell a call that's further out of the money, reduces your cost on the initial call that you bought, but then you also have to be willing, if the market continues to rise, which you will like, that you'd be willing to sell another portion of your crop at the strike price you sold that call at. In other words, buying something on the cheap just doesn't work anymore. You've got to be willing to spend some money for that needed protection.
So let me see here. When corn was $3 and I spent 30 cents, that was reasonable. Now corn is $70, 10%, 70 cents. That's reasonable. It's more of a percentage of the total than it is rather than the money involved per se for the call or the put.
Exactly.
I heard Joe talk about OTC, and I thought, where's the horse race? But you're not talking about horses. You're talking about something else. Tell us more about over-the-counter markets, and then tell us a few more of those things that you were hinting about in your opening remarks.
Well, the over-the-counter markets is something that have been used, you know, not only in the grain markets, but actually a lot more so in financial markets, energy markets, metals, and in general they've been used by larger, more institutional, commercial-type customers. Our company and a lot of other companies are extending these services kind of down the chain as of late. And, you know, you might get something through your elevator that is similar to what we might be able to do for you on the over-the-counter. If you've ever done anything like an accumulator or a cash plus, which I know some guys have probably been burned by them, and I know that there's some guys out there this year, That's the kind of stuff that's available to you. They essentially offer premium pricing in exchange for, you know, a portion of your grain if the market is to go higher to a certain price. So there's nothing here that's really rocket science. It's just the difference between what a lot of people are doing in the over-the-counters and what they're doing on the board is that it's all set in stone. It's something you don't necessarily watch every day, and it essentially does the marketing plan for you. We've got deals that we're doing now where, you know, you give us X number of days and X number of bushels, and we're going to price them out over that period of days, you know, using a premium pricing model. And if at a certain day the price of a bushel of corn is over a certain price, you're going to owe us twice as many bushels. So it's essentially a lot of the OTC contracts that we offer are very similar to things that your elevator might offer. The thing with what the clearing firms are doing now is they're going to be able to get you a better deal. And that's what it comes down to. I don't see it right now as a viable tool for producers. I think down the road it will be. And I think it's something that's going to be offered on you know, a wider scale. You're going to see people like me and people like these IBs here that are going to be able to offer these things to even the smallest of producers. So it's something to keep your eye on. I don't think it's something that you need to jump into right now. As far as outside-the-box type things, you know, there are, like we've talked about, the volatility here is so massive. I don't really think that there's anything that you can rule out. A couple of things that we've talked about and what we've seen. You know, the first thing is what I like to do is what-if scenarios. What if this were to happen? What if this were to happen? And how is that going to affect you as a producer? One of the more basic what-if issues, and crop insurance takes care of a lot of this, but, you know, what if you have a crop failure? Think about that scenario this year and think about where you would be, you know, come the fall if you were to have a crop failure. Talk to some of the corn producers in the western counties of Illinois and ask them what happened to their corn crop last year. I've got the yields here. There are guys that went from 175 one year down to under 120 the next year. I mean, if that were to happen to you, are you set up in the right kind of situation? Some more, you know, bigger and maybe thinking out of the realm of possibility, what ifs. You know, one thing that we've talked about in our office several times, and I've talked about this with the research staff and everybody else, is, you know, we've talked a lot about crude oil here today. I've heard crude oil mentioned tons of times. You know, crude oil is a market that a lot of people, you know, the media, whoever, may consider to be the kind of the king of commodities right now. If you're to think of commodities, you're going to think, oh, crude oil is the big one, and, you know, that's going to lead the way in the grains, whatever. You know, crude oil was a market that for the longest time traded $10, $15, $20. And all of a sudden, $85 is normal. $100 is a little high, but it's not that high compared to what's out there. You know, what if you take that in comparison with some of the other commodities out there, say corn, say soybeans, and you were to put that in a percentage scenario, I mean, does that mean that, you know, $15 or $20 corn is possible in the next 5 to 10 years? And, you know, judged on things that Tom and Roy said, you know, if we're running out of space to grow the stuff here, you know, who's to say that couldn't happen? And who's to say it's not possible within the next 5 years, within the next 3 years even? Because if you were to go back 4 or 5 years, nobody would have thought $8 corn was possible. I mean, is that a situation that you're ready for as a producer? Are you set up if something like that were to happen? And, you know, maybe, you know, call me crazy. Maybe it's not possible, but, you know, I think it is. And maybe it's not right now, maybe it's 3 years from now, but, you know, just make sure that you know that, you know, something like that is possible. Along those same lines, you know, government intervention is something that a lot of people would say that we've seen too much of lately. What if the government does intervene with grain prices? What if they decide that we're too high and they're going to pull subsidies and they're going to pull all kinds of money out of your pocket and they're going to leave these funds with their hands tied and they've got to get out? You know, what if the adverse situation were to happen and we all of a sudden go back down to $2 or $3? Are you ready for that? Are you ready for it to happen this year or next year? You know, you got to really think of these kind of what-if scenarios in your heads. Another thing, talk to a seed salesman. Talk to him about the technologies that they've got coming up. Is it possible that corn yields could double in the next 10 years? That national averages could be 250, 300? And is that possible? A lot of seed guys will tell you it is, and they'll tell you that the technology's out there. And, you know, if that were to happen, you know, where does that leave corn prices? Where does it leave demand? And, you know, what's that going to do for you? Do you have enough bin space? Do you've got the kind of resources that it's going to take to you know deal with that kind of crop? And these are all things that I think you really got to kind of be ready for. Another thing that's happening right now, the Illinois guys will tell you that the Illinois government's in bad shape with money. What if we were to see some of these defaults on municipal bonds? What if the state of Illinois decides that they're going to default on pensions or on any kind of government funding? Where does that leave the markets? Where does that leave investors? The way I see it, if this thing kind of deal were to start happening, you know, on a more widespread scenario, you could see all kinds of funds pull out money out of anything, corn, soybeans, the stock market, anything. They're not going to want to own anything if we can't trust the government with, you know, whether it be state governments, federal governments. If we can't trust the governments to pay back their debts, you know, what is anything worth these days? And that's something that, you know, I think is a real possibility. You know, God forbid it should happen, but if it did, you know, it could cause some real problems here. So I guess my main thing, I think in this day and age especially, I think you've really got to be ready for anything to happen, good, bad, ugly. I think that you've got to leave yourself some flexibility. You've got to use the tools that we've talked about, whether it be put options, crop insurance, any of that kind of stuff. Make sure you know what's available to you. Make sure you know how to use it and be ready for, you know, any of these scenarios, as wacky as some of them may sound.
Les Schulte over here has the portable wireless microphone. He'll be going around the room looking for questions. Get them ready. Raise your hand if you have a question, because I'm going to be going to you here in just one moment. Roy, I heard it time and again said corn is a slam dunk. You really got to work hard to mess this up from a producer standpoint and make some money. Are there scenarios out there that potentially, though, that could mess this up? And I'm thinking of what I heard, for example, over the weekend on Meet the Press, where it was hinted that the U.S. is considering dipping into its strategic oil reserve. Your comments, sir.
USDA doesn't know how bad it is yet. They haven't shown us anything except a little bit of a tight corn deal. The census says we don't have any inflation. Why were they going to go into the reserves? There's not a problem. That's what they tell us. There's not a problem.
Right.
So I think they've got to admit a problem before they do something like opening the reserves. I want to go back and answer the question you asked Tom.
Oh, go ahead.
Can I?
Oh, please.
Toolbox. The most important tool you got in your toolbox is a smart partner. I don't care if it's your wife. I don't care if it's your kid. Somebody that can help you. Somebody you can talk to. Because we get emotionally connected to our corn crop, right?
It's their baby.
That's why you put two rows of fertilizer down the outside rows, right? No, I think that you have to have a partner. You have to have somebody that's helping you look at the numbers. You have to have somebody that's helping you trade the plan. And I've said all over this year to everybody that's talked to me that cash has to lead this market if it's going to have a lasting rally, and we've not had any cash leadership. And I think the reason for that is that you've been more than pleased with the prices you're getting, and you've sold corn much earlier than I thought people would this year. So I think that the corn movement has held the prices down, and I think that we'll run out of corn eventually this year. And when we do, then all the fear that we've had will come to pass. We've not had any fear yet. We've not had any panic yet. It's been very methodical. Now, Dave, go back. What was the question that you wanted me to answer that was?
Oh, I was saying that already the government is talking about that strategic reserve.
Yeah. For some reason this week, we have developed a fear that higher oil prices is no longer bullish corn because of ethanol margins, but it is bearish the world economies. A $20 rally in crude oil prices would take the world GDP down 0.5%. an additional $20 would take you down another 1%. And I'm not talking about China and India where your GDP is running 9 or 10%. I'm talking about places like the EU and the U.S. where it's running at 2.5 to 3%, okay? The turnaround in our economies is still rather fragile. And I think that the issue about higher energy prices is a contentious one. If you look at the supplies of crude oil and the supplies of gasoline in the United States, they're burdensome. There's no reason why we should be paying $3.85 or $4 for a gallon of gasoline. But we are, and it's happening because of big energy protecting their margins. And I think that this year, at some point, the trade will work up and they'll figure out what crack margins are, and we'll go back and we'll address this issue. If BP comes back this year with a multi-billion dollar profit, we'll know exactly what's going on.
Questions? Is there a question in the audience for our panelists? Are y'all tired? There's one back there. Interest rates. Did you say interest rates? What is going to happen with interest rates? That's a wonderful question.
Do you have money? They're not going up. Do you need to borrow money? They're going to get real expensive.
So the whole U.S. interest rate infrastructure depends on you, sir.
If you have a variable rate mortgage or a loan with a variable rate on it, you better get it locked in immediately. That would be my advice. You guys may feel different. I don't know.
I agree.
I agree 100%.
Well, let's explore this just a smidge more. Does the Fed have an end game for getting out of QE2 and potential QE3? And if so, what does it potentially look like, and how could it potentially impact the grain farmer?
What's QE2 and QE3 mean?
Quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing, which we're in right now, which is keeping interest rates low. Tom?
The government's been supporting low interest rates. If you're a big institution, you can borrow money for next to nothing. You're going to go invest that money, and you're going to make more money as a big institution. What was the phrase Mr. Reagan had many years ago, the trickle-down effect? These low interest rates are not trickling down to us, the consumer. Try to get a loan these days. Sure, they're going to offer you cheap rates, but the hoops you have to jump through nowadays to get that loan, it's unbelievable. The government has talked about in recent days about doing away with ending the QE2 program. What that will mean is it's going to rely on the rest of this country, the rest of this world, to buy our interest rate vehicles. Are they going to do it? Do you know who the biggest debt holder of U.S. debt is? Right. There's many people that are afraid they're going to own this country, just like Japan tried to do in the early 80s. And what was the net result? Higher interest rates. So, no, I think with all the money that's out there, with rising prices for energy and foodstuffs, I think higher interest rates are inevitable.
Question right here.
I've heard you talk about a lot of different things, but I haven't heard you mention taxes. And if the governments are in as bad a shape as they are, the schools are as in bad a shape as they are, it's inevitable that taxes are going to go up, and land taxes are going to be where it's going to hurt the most, and especially people who have a lot of land. My grandfather, 60 years ago, used to say that he supported a third of the county that went to school because he owned land and the other people just had their house and so forth. So what's going to happen when that happens?
Are you from Illinois or Indiana?
From Michigan.
Okay.
I live in Indiana.
Okay. In Illinois, I'm an Illinois resident, and in early mid-January, they raised the state income tax without a single budget cut. I nearly got sick all over myself.
Well, people started talking about they were going to pull out of Chicago. The business people were going to pull out of Chicago, Boeing, et cetera, because the taxes were going up.
I think it's inevitable that we're going to have a higher tax rate. But we also have to have the budget cuts. And without the budget cuts, higher taxes won't work. We have to stop the spending. And the this is my opinion. And the spending that we're doing in a lot of areas is going to cut into agriculture. I firmly believe that we should not be subsidizing the ethanol industry. You tell me here is a business that can't operate profitably without government assistance, you don't belong here.
Questions? We have one right over here. Yes, sir.
Historically, at this time of year, the risk is usually to the downside, which has been favorable for selling early. But are we entering in a situation now? Which way do you see the greater risk, up or down, as we are proceeding from here?
We'll start with Joe.
Conventional wisdom would certainly say that the risk is to the downside. I don't know if conventional wisdom is necessarily the best way to market your grain now. I think that you've got to understand that there is more upside potential than ever before, but you've got to have yourself covered. You've got to do something to lock something in. You've got to sell something. If that means re-owning it, do it. But I can't necessarily sit up here and tell you that I know for sure that that there's more risk to the downside at this point. I know that the seasonals tell you, if you look at any of that stuff, yeah, generally we're going to put in our highs in the grain markets in, you know, February, March, April, whatever may have you. I can't tell you that I firmly believe that that's the situation this year. Not to get up here and say that I'm real bullish, because I'm not necessarily feeling that way, but I think that with what's going on right now, with the situation that we have, I don't think that you necessarily have to resort yourself to that opinion.
Roy, you can take a shot at that one too, please.
I'd like to go back to the last two questions, if I may.
Well, golly.
I'm sorry. Ethanol has replaced 10% of our imported petroleum products. And if ethanol wasn't here to replace 10% of our imported products, I want to know what you think gasoline would cost today. It's a security issue. It has nothing to do with economies. The second thing that I would say is that if it weren't for ethanol, which is going to use 5 billion bushels of corn next year, if it wasn't for the fact that ethanol could get pushed aside, that provides a reserve of corn for the rest of us to use for feeding animals or making corn fructose or whatever you want to make out of it. I felt in January that we were going to cut our ethanol consumption this year because corn got too expensive. And then we rallied crude oil from $75 to $105, and ethanol margins are back to 30 cents a bushel. I don't think that we could have built our ethanol industry without some sort of subsidy. And I don't think the subsidies of $5 billion a year in ethanol are anywhere close to what we subsidize roads, what we subsidize railroads, what we subsidize intermarket, the inner city buses. I want to tell you, last week on Thursday, we had a problem in Chicago. The entire city got locked down in gridlock. Ice. was falling off of the Willis X Sears Tower. They blocked traffic for 4 blocks around the Sears Tower. I couldn't get anywhere in a taxi. I had to walk where I was going, and for miles and miles and miles. I had no idea that the state of Illinois, let alone the city of Chicago, had so many articulated buses. Every block had 5 of them. And I'm talking about 4 miles. All of those are subsidized. About 1/2 of them had 3 people in them. Okay. So you can talk about the subsidies for ethanol, but we're putting subsidies in a lot of other things besides ethanol. And at least ethanol is allowing us not to buy something from people who hate us. It's also provided an awful lot of jobs.
Question over here, sir.
There's a subject that hasn't been mentioned here today, which I think can be the greatest threat to agriculture.
And
it's
Dave Dickey?
It's an agency that is out of control, and I think all of us are asleep at the wheel. It's the EPA. Last year, President Obama gave $7 billion to EPA from the stimulus money, and they are trying to dismantle production agriculture one piece at a time out of this country. And so all I'm saying is that we better be aware and we better be informed of what's going on, because it could be far more detrimental to production agriculture in America than anything else.
Questions? Going once. There's one that away.
Thank you. Going back to ethanol, there is still something about this, well, more than one thing, that I don't understand. Is it a subsidy? In other words, does the federal government write out a check to the Andersons or ADM or whoever? Or is it a credit against taxes? In other words, taxes that are not paid that otherwise would have been. I would say that there's a big difference between a subsidy and a tax deduction or a tax credit, and I really don't know how it works.
It is a credit against taxes. And it is not paid to the Andersons. It is not paid to Poet. It's not paid to Greenhaven. It's paid to the energy czar that buys ethanol to blend with unleaded gasoline.
Questions?
How about one trade that you'd recommend that you think would be the best trade for the spring here?
Everybody get your pens out. Go ahead, Tom.
I like buying November beans. Your turn, Joe.
We were talking about this earlier. I like the bean spreads on a correction. I like bull spread in July. No, if you get a little bit of a setback, which we already have, maybe wait for the dust to settle.
Roy?
Got your pencil ready? In Brazil, in the month of January, they made 14 point, well, this is not true. In the month of January, the Brazil biodiesel production was 48% higher than it was in January the year before. In 2010, Brazil made 14.8 million barrels of biodiesel. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot. 14.8 is not a big deal. Takes 2 billion pounds of soy oil to make 14.8 billion barrels. 2 million tons of soybean oil happens to be 33% of all the soybean oil that the Brazilian crush created. It's 5% of all the soybean oil made in the United States or made in the world. So I think that soybean oil will lead the bean complex, probably goes back and trades 70 cents, could be higher. So you don't want to be short soybean oil. But in this environment, you have to have something against it. I mean, you just can't trade soybean oil for soybean oil unless you've got a whole lot of money. It fits with a bigger issue, and that is generally, forgive me.
Is that soybean train?
It's my wife. I think that if the markets, not if, but when the markets come back to life, it's going to be led by people food, rice, wheat, sugar, and soybean oil.
All right. Roy Huckabee of the Lind Group, Joe Vaclavec of MF Global, and Tom Fritz of EFG, all in Chicago. Give them a hand, please.